On the podcast with me now is Stefan Scheip of Scholar Financial Advising. He's one of our recommended financial advisors, one of our premium recommended financial advisors. There's a short list of those. If you go to the recommended page under whitecoatinvestor.com/recommended. And he's here to kind of be introduced to you as an audience, but also to help us to answer your questions. And I think we've got a couple of great questions that we'll be going over together from the audience here that I think his input will be very valuable on. But before we get into that, can you tell the audience why you decided to become a financial advisor in the first place?
Yeah, happy to do that. Thank you for having me on today. It started a while ago. I've always been a finance guy, kind of through and through, even back into middle school, high school, interested in the markets, and naturally led into a finance degree. And that led into graduate school. So went to get my PhD in finance and had a focus from a dissertation research area on executive compensation and conflicts of interest. And so I was dealing a lot in that area, that realm. And I had the unfortunate experience of being pitched whole life insurance, right, as a grad student, which made no sense to me, but really started to make me question how much this person had to disclose about how much they were going to get paid on me being pitched this policy. And that caused me to switch around my research interest a little bit to still focusing on compensation and conflicts of interest, but on investment advisors and really looking at investment advisor disclosures and conflicts of interest that arise because of different fee structures. Ended up writing a couple papers on it. I worked with the state of Massachusetts on new regulation related to fee structure disclosures and had the unfortunate experience there of having to explain to 300 investment advisors in Boston how I thought it was a great idea that their clients knew more clearly how they were being charged for investment advice. And that kind of rubbed me the wrong way, that that something that seemed so obvious to me, right, was taken as a negative, right? That people, that should be hidden somewhere from a fee structure. So wanted to start my own firm and focused a lot on trying to start a firm that minimized conflicts of interest as much as possible. And I knew I didn't want to take AUM, right? There would be absolutely no commissions. And what we have today is the culmination of that, right? It's a growing firm. We have 5 advisors on staff, all past professors or current professors in finance, also holding PhDs. So it's very like-minded on the academic side of whether things are being pitched right to you and what really is the truth of what's going on in those investments, and acting as true advisors, right? Since there's nothing, no skin in the game there of how we're managing assets or anything like that, right? We don't manage them. You still maintain control of your accounts. I don't want your passwords. I don't want to have anything like that. But we show up as advisors instead of wealth managers.
Yeah, it's a pretty neat approach. And, you know, it's interesting when I look at who your, you know, ideal client is. You say it's a do-it-yourself investor who doesn't want to pay asset under management fees, but wants advice. And he's getting it from professors. You know, 5 PhDs are the people giving the advice at the firm. That's pretty unique. So tell us about, you know, all this talk about fee structures. What is your fee structure?
Yeah, so happy to go into that. And as I said, it was a long way to get there because it's so unique, right? In the sense that a lot of firms, and I've put the paper on it, right? 99% of advisors are going to charge an AUM fee, and they'll charge you the 1%. Maybe they give you a little break, right? Get you down to 70, 80 bips. All right. So the way we charge, we have 2 kind of paths depending on what the client's looking for. The first is where the bulk of our clients work is on an hourly structure, right? So we charge $350 an hour. And when a client comes in, one of my worries of an hourly fee structure is I didn't want to be associated with these runaway costs where somebody starts talking to me and then they find out that they get a call and say, well, you know, that 401k is taking us another 10 hours or anything like that, right? It's so the clients know upfront what the project cost would be. So a client calls, we walk through kind of what they're going through, what issues they're running into, what they need advice on, and we build out custom plans for them. So there's no kind of boilerplate plans that we deal with for everybody and general recommendations. A lot of the advice we're giving are answers and questions that are non-Googleable, right? When they come into it, everybody's unique and there's a lot of different unique facets of people's finances. So we build out a proposal and it is exactly as you said, it's for do-it-yourself investors, right? So they're managing their accounts and we're providing the shopping list for each of the accounts of what they need to buy, the recommendations, right? And they get a flat fee upfront of this is how much time it's going to take us and the fee associated with it. That would be the first and the bulk of the clients there. What we found is that there was a need for more, right? We had a lot of clients come back and say, that's great, right? We're doing our semi-annual meetings or annual meetings, but there's a lot of complexity going on here, whether they have their own business. Right now, we're dealing with accountants multiple times a year and attorneys multiple times a year, because it's really a team effort, right? When you're dealing with somebody's finance, especially after a certain level, and we normally see that around the $10 to $15 million in assets level, right, and above, is when things start getting a little weird out there, right? And taxable accounts become a significant part of the portfolio, which causes its own tax consequences. Obviously, real estate starts to become a bigger factor, both direct investments or indirect investments. Many of those clients are entrepreneurs. So we're dealing with things like succession planning, legacy goals, right? Issues related to picking 401k providers for their employees, right? Lots of issues that come in. So we essentially have a family office set up for those clients where there's no more us sending you a bill for a project and back and forth every single month. We're your family office. Right? We act as your personal CFO, and any finance issue whatsoever that shows up is just a forward button to us, right? And we handle all that on the back end. So that's our retainer model. That sets up, we do have minimums for that one because we frankly don't believe that everyone needs that, right? In many cases, right? So a minimum of $10 million in assets or $1 million in income, right, is generally where that starts to be a concern, right? And those are tiered at $3,000, $6,000, and $10,000 a month, right, for ongoing fees.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into some of the audience's questions. Our first one comes in by email. This doc says, I am 5 years out of training and paid off my primary home and a rental property. I've been maximizing my 403B, 457 for a year and 529 for a year. No debt due to getting my medical education in India. I have a few questions. I'm trying to copy your asset allocation and having a hard time due to some options in our 403B. We don't have small cap value funds in our 403B or 457. We do have a Vanguard small cap index fund and a Vanguard equity index fund. I'd like to know your thoughts on small cap value index versus small cap index funds. I'd also appreciate your opinion on mid cap value and large cap value funds. Is it okay to invest in mid cap value instead of small cap value? Well, there's a lot of underlying questions there about asset allocation. Where would you start with somebody like this that's got asset allocation questions?
Yeah, so I guess you said a lot to unpack. So maybe start from the top there that it's a common issue, right, is that all asset allocations look really great until you actually have to implement them in a 401k or a 403b, and then you find out that not all of the Vanguard funds exist anywhere else, and some of them are horrible. I mean, there's some really bad 401ks out there when it comes to investment options. So I think it's good, right, that from, I guess, from the onset, right, it's fantastic that they're going through this already, right, that they already have the 403b, 457 filled up. My next step, or probably pre-step, would be a backdoor Roth, and then taxable accounts are next. And that's really where you have a lot more flexibility on the choices. Now, getting into the small cap versus mid cap discussion, anything else, this is something that comes up regularly, and it's a granular, it's a distinction without a difference, really, is what it comes down to. Because if you run correlations on these funds, right, a small cap value fund is going to be correlated to a small cap index fund at 98%, right? So if you have the option for a small cap index fund and you're trying to get that exposure, you're going to be just fine doing that. And even mid cap value versus small cap value is going to be around 97% as well. Right. So the important part is actually having the exposure, right? I wouldn't worry too much about, do you have the exact fund that gets you that exact issue, right? Or that exact exposure. It does start to open up a bigger question, which is growth versus value, right? And where those are at, because the value funds are highly correlated, the growth versus value side are not as correlated, right? They're very different in how they're structured. And one of the things that the person's going to likely see is once they start going into taxable accounts and everything, that asset allocation is important, but asset location is going to start becoming even more important. Because we have to start thinking about, if you don't have great options in the 403B or the 401ks or anything, maybe we can make up for that with holding those assets outside in the taxable account and Roth accounts, and doing so from a tax efficient manner, right? I mean, that's the issue that I see a lot of people run into, is they see this asset allocation, they try to replicate that asset allocation in every single account, right? And that is a huge mistake, right? Because all of these accounts are going to be taxed differently, right? They grow differently. There's R&D differences, there are legacy differences. There's a lot of issues there. And when you look at the literature, you're talking 20, 25 basis points a year in value, just in making sure the right stuff is in the right account, right? Not only the asset allocation side. And from the value perspective is one that commonly comes in, is everyone wants to buy the S&P 500, right? Or buy the market, which I completely agree with. I mean, I'm all for that idea. The issue is it's more efficient, though, if you split, right, that total market into value and growth, right? Because together, they are the market, right? But the big distinction is when you look at something like growth stocks or value stocks, it's really, they're not stagnant, right? They move every year. They get rebalanced as value or growth, right? A good example of this was over the past years, Facebook, right? And Facebook's was a growth stock, right? And then it became a value stock because it lost 80% of its value. And then it became a growth stock again because it gained afterwards, right? So these aren't concrete definitions of who is a value stock and who is a growth stock. Now, there's some that stay pretty similar, but a lot of people miss the kind of definition that happens is that if you took every stock in the S&P 500, right, and you ranked them on market to book ratio is what's happening, and they cut it, and they said, these stocks over here have a lot of growth in the past year, right, so their market to book ratios are really high, so they're growing, right, they're typically not paying a lot of dividends, which is the key part from a tax efficiency standpoint, right, so there's a lot of growth happening over here. On the value side, right, you end up with this weird mix of these boring kind of companies, right, that aren't growing at a high pace. These are your Procter & Gamble's, your Bank of America. I mean, Procter & Gamble is not reinventing toothpaste and toilet paper anytime soon, right? So you have these which pay a really high dividend, and you also have this combination of stocks or companies that have dropped in value, right? And that's really where you get the upside potential on the value funds. It's not the Procter & Gamble's and JP Morgan's and Berkshire's, right? Those will give you a consistent return, but it's the stocks that have fallen so much that they're no longer considered growth, they're considered value, that have added risk and had added potential reward. When it comes to the tax efficiency side, that's why we really need to start thinking about, instead of thinking about the market or total exposure to equities, is exposure to value and exposure to growth. Because if we take those value stocks that are throwing off 3% in dividends, the last thing, right, a client in their earnings years need is more income, right, being thrown off from their portfolio, right? It's going to be taxed at the highest rates. So those are the stocks we want to keep in the Roth, right? Or we want to keep in the 403B if we have the option of the 401Ks, right? And we can take the growth component, right, of those and keep that in the taxable so they can just continue to rise and you're not having all that income thrown off of those accounts. But you get step up in basis for estate planning, right? Capital gains is going to be much lower. So there's a lot of different options that start to open up for this person. I'm glad they're thinking about this whole value growth distinction, because it is something that people miss, right? And they fall too much in the weeds of allocation to small cap and mid cap and large cap, which is absolutely important. But once that's set, right, it's a tax game, right? And it's trying to allocate this stuff in the right location.
Yeah, and it varies for everybody, that allocation, because their ratios of the various accounts are different. You know, some people are mostly taxable, some people have a tiny little taxable account. But here's the deal, right? Choose your asset allocation, and don't choose an asset allocation just because it's my asset allocation, right? Choose one that you can stick with in the long term. But there's lots of reasonable asset allocations over there. And then try to implement it as best you can, looking at all of your accounts, implementing it across all of your accounts, right? I mean, take what's good in your 403B and use that. But the more complex your asset allocation, the harder it's going to be to implement that in your 403B or 457B. If you got two or three funds in your asset allocation, two or three asset classes, that's probably not very hard to implement. Right? There's probably an international fund. There's probably a bond fund. There's probably a U.S. stock fund there, and you can implement it just fine. If you got 10 asset classes, almost surely you can't put them all in your 403B because it just won't be available. It's got to be in your Roth IRA. It's got to be in a taxable account. It's got to be somewhere else. And sometimes you just kind of get stuck. You're like, well, I can't have exactly what I want. And you get as close as you can and deal with it and recognize that investment options change as the years go by, and the ratios of the amounts in these various accounts change as the years go by. So do the best you can and implement your plan as much as you can, and then follow it. You know, I think that's kind of the key when it comes to portfolio construction.
Absolutely.
All right. So the next one, and this speak pipe, I mean, this question is teed up for, you know, a financial advisor on the show for sure. But let's listen to this, and then we're going to talk about, you know, who needs some financial advisor. What are maybe some thoughts or some uses for a financial advisor that maybe one hasn't had. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Dr. Dolly. This is Matthew, an internist from California. You often talk about either literally or figuratively someone firing their financial advisor. However, commonly in a marriage, only one of the two individuals is significantly interested in managing their investment portfolio and finances personally, and has taken the extraordinary step of becoming financially savvy enough to manage their own high net worth portfolio. My concern with foregoing the services of a fee-only financial advisor is that if I was to die, early or unexpectedly, my wife would not be interested or currently competent to take on the responsibility of managing a 7 or 8 figure net worth portfolio. She has no interest now or in the future of spending months to years developing that investment management competency. While she could, upon my death, go find a fee-only financial advisor, it seems like this would not be top of her list of things to have to deal with, and there could be significant costs involved in potentially moving the investment portfolio. Wouldn't you agree that since having one spouse more interested in investment management than the other is probably more the rule than the exception, shouldn't most couples be using a fee-only financial advisor from the beginning as somewhat of an insurance policy, so to speak, to make things easier on the surviving, non-financially savvy spouse?
All right. Well, I think the first thing to say about this is kind of reiterate my position on advisors. My estimate is that about 80% of docs need and want, quite frankly, a good financial advisor that gives them good advice at a fair price. I throw that number out to Dr. Bill Bernstein, and he tells me that's way too low. He thinks the number is 99% of docs ought to be using a financial advisor. But this brings up, you know, when should someone get a financial advisor? Who needs one? Does everyone need one? What should you do if you like being a do-it-yourselfer, but your spouse really has no interest in it? What are your thoughts on who actually needs an advisor?
Yeah, this is an interesting question because it's when I first started firm, I was not expecting this question, right? This wasn't the thing that you're expecting as starting a financial advisory firm. You're ready for the 401k questions and the asset allocation. And I've got to say, this is probably one of the most common questions I get, if not the most common question that I get from potential clients. And I think the distinction really comes down to, do you need a wealth manager or do you need an advisor, right? And unfortunately, those fall under the same definitions a lot, right? And I would obviously, right, be under the opinion that most people don't need a wealth manager, right? But they need the advice, right? Because especially in today's age, right, the ability to place trades, right, and access accounts, it's not like you have to call a broker and have, you know, trades placed over the phone and days to clear. And you can easily hop online and place account trades in Fidelity or Vanguard or any of these things very easily. I'd say most people do need some sort of advice. The question is the level of advice that they need. And that's usually where people, I think, split on whether or not they need it, because they go into kind of a traditional advisory firm and they say, I need advice. And they say, well, that's great. We're just going to take 1% of your eight figure portfolio, right, for that advice. And that's not really what they're looking for, right? They're looking for exactly what this caller mentioned, right, is that they know, and which is very common, right? Agree that it is the rule opposed to the exception that generally in a relationship, there's one person that's the, what I consider like the family CFO, right? And they're watching the investments. They understand the pitfalls of hiring an advisor, right? If they had to pick an advisor, they would pick a good one, right? They would know what background research they'd have to do. But in the back of the mind, the problem is exactly this. If something happens to them, right, and they die, who does the spouse call? And the worst part is it's very easy to call bad advisors, right? And that's also, right, the issue. That is almost like a fear problem as well, right? Of if something happens and you've accumulated this wealth and you have a great financial plan, it doesn't take long for someone to really screw that up with the wrong advice going forward. So a lot of the times we'll have clients come in for exactly this reason and say, listen, I think we're doing okay, right? We just like that to build that relationship. And we spend a lot of time from a relationship perspective with our clients, right? We're not really into somebody coming in, build you a plan, kind of throw it at you as you're walking out the door, and we'll see you in 10 years, 20 years, if ever, right? We want to build that rapport in that relationship because things come up, right? It's like finding a doctor, right? In the sense of the time to find a doctor is not when you need one, right? You should have a relationship built, right? You should have that understanding, and they should understand what your needs are, right? Because finance and health, right? hand in hand. They're very personal, right? And the last thing that most people want, they agree, is your spouse having to go in the midst of a horrible event in their life, right? Now they have to go interview financial advisors in something that they have absolutely no interest in doing. And that is not a good scenario to be in. So I would agree. I think the number is high for the need for a financial advisor, right? For someone to provide that advice, right? And more importantly, to build the relationship. So that's there. And when events come up, right, you have someone to call, right? And someone to bounce ideas off of, right? And not to, I mean, that's a big thing with us, is we don't dictate what needs to be done. It's, we're here to provide what we think you should do, right? And then provide floors and ceilings around it of saying, you know, this is what we think you should save, or this is what we think you should do. But if you didn't do that and you decided to do this, this is what the impact's going to be, right? Lay out all the risks and potential kind of returns there. And then this is the floor, right? You can't go below this number, right? That's not going to end up being good, right? And ultimately, then the client is in control of where that falls. But this is a big one, and it's a tough one to have. I would say no matter who somebody works with, in the meetings with an advisor, right, both of you should be in attendance, right? You should both be in there. They don't have to be the one uploading documents and dealing with the accounts and all of that kind of stuff. But I think there's a big benefit of at least the other spouse who's not the CFO to spend that hour or two of a year of at least knowing who the advisor is, knowing that they have met them before they have to call them. And at least they have the idea of a general strategy. What's going on? Where are assets held, right? What does it look like? Because I see that a lot too. Somebody will come in and say, I didn't even know we had that account, right? And they're looking at their spouse saying, did you know, right? And it's like, well, yeah, that one of you knows, right? But the other has no idea you had a safety deposit box, or that you have this account over here, what the strategy is and who this account saved for, right? So even just the awareness, right, of having somebody else involved, so that way all that can be brought together, is a big benefit. But yeah, this is a credit to him to thinking about this, because it is something that generally doesn't show up for a while, right? Before people start wondering, like, well, what would happen if something were to happen to me?
Yeah, I think the bare minimum, even for a hardcore do-it-yourselfer, if your spouse is not really that interested, the bare minimum is to select the financial advisor they should go to in should the worst happen to you. I think that's the bare minimum. And put a letter together, you know, to your spouse and that financial advisor that includes, you know, these are the assets we have, here's what we've been doing, you know, and here's where you can find everything. I think that's the bare minimum.
Completely agree.
Ideally, both spouses would be participating, be at least a little bit more interested than maybe is being described in this case. But that isn't always the case. A lot of times it is very much one spouse that's been doing this, and it's often the man. And men often, you know, marry a younger woman and don't have as long of a life expectancy anyway. And so for almost every couple, there's going to come a time when the less experienced person is responsible for the finances. And so I think it's great to have a backup plan in some way, shape, or form. That might involve someone you've been doing checkups with every year or two. It might involve, you know, just a name to call. It might involve having a formal financial advisor, but I think you're right. Every couple, every family is going to have to choose what level of advice they need and are willing to pay for.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've been talking with Stefan Scheip with Scholar Financial Advising. You can get more information about that firm at scholarfinancialadvising.com. Thanks so much for being on the WCI podcast and for sponsoring us.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.